Welcome to The Author Confidential, the podcast dedicated to supporting authors and those wanting to be by pulling back the curtain on book writing, publishing, and marketing. I'm your host, Lisbeth Tanz. Each week, we'll explore those burning questions that keep prospective authors up at night. You'll learn from professionals in the industry, as well as seasoned authors who've slogged through the writing trenches and lived to tell about it. So grab a drink and settle in as we dive into this latest episode. Hi, welcome to The Author Confidential. I'm Lisbeth Tanz. Today we're going to talk about stress. It's all around us and inside us, and it's an epidemic in our society today. And my guest is intimately familiar with stress and its negative consequences if they're ignored. My guest today is Professor Pete Alexander, author of Lighten Your Day, Fast, Easy, and Effective Stress Relief for When Shit Happens. Pete, welcome to The Author Confidential.
Elizabeth, thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, and I appreciate that you sent over your book so that I could take a look at it, because I have to say, it's a compendium of solutions, and I've never seen all of these in one place.
That's exactly it. I after what happened to me, I realized that it wasn't just me. There were a lot of other people who just, they were so stressed out with all the various responsibilities on their plate that they just didn't have the time to read, you know, a 300-page book just on meditation, for example. And so I realized that, you know, let's give something that people can reach for, and in 1 or 2 minutes, they can try a technique just before they go into a stressful meeting or a presentation. And it's a good niche to help people out with.
Absolutely. And before we jump into some of your solutions, let's talk a little bit about some of the facts that you stated in your book. And I'm looking at I have the PDF. So I'm looking on page 21. Let's see, that is actually page 10 of your book. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about some of those? And were you surprised by any of the research that you did on stress and how we are living our lives today?
No, actually not. It just reinforced for what I was saying, because I think back to when we first started getting the smartphones and we were able to stay connected with work in particular. And I thought at first, how great is that? Because I can at any time, whether it's in the evening or on weekends, et cetera, I can take a look and respond back to an email as opposed to waiting until I got into the office on Monday morning. And then I realized, you know, later in my career that was actually more of a curse, because now our society is always on and we're constantly being inundated with messages because of the electronics. And so the research looking at it, nothing there surprised me. I mean, it basically, everything that you do from a simple Google search, you know, it will corroborate with what I found, which is we are totally stressed out because there's always so much that we have on our plates, responsibilities, whether it be work, whether it be personal lives, and we're always on. So we're not giving ourselves enough mental and physical breaks to recharge. And that's the key. I mean, it's amazing. And the dollars, I think, you know, like one of the studies says that it's costing employers $500 billion annually, because 38% of U.S. employees who miss work due to on-the-job stress may be absent from work for 6 days or more per month. And not only is it that, but what it doesn't talk about is the term presenteeism, which is when you go to work, but you're mentally or physically or both just not there, and you're just kind of there in body only, mm-hmm. and you're not being productive, and it's not even accounting for that. It's just crazy. And you know, everything is saying that stress is something that we absolutely have to take into consideration, because it is the precursor to burnout. And when you have either mental or physical burnout, then it's too late. Then you're forced to have to do something. And you don't want to get to that point. In fact, the World Health Organization calls stress the number one health epidemic of the 21st century.
And, you know, stress doesn't necessarily have to be like as maybe we define it in the US. I mean, food insecurity is a huge stressor. Mm-hmm. War is a huge stressor. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't surprise me that the World Health Organization would say that, because what country right now doesn't have some type of major stressor going on in it? Maybe Canada. I don't know. Maybe not.
I don't think Canada, because I just did a presentation last week at an HR conference, and I did research to find out specifically about the Canadian market, and 1 in 5 Canadian workers are experiencing some mental stress. So it's happening there. I would say if I was going to pick a particular country, the one that's not as stressed maybe would be Switzerland, because they never take sides. So that would be my guess.
Yeah, there's got to be a country out there. I don't know, Iceland, Norway, somewhere that's just, you know, life is a breeze. I would rather live there.
I think we all would.
Yes. So, and then everyone would be stressed because we'd all be in this no stress place and ruin it.
Isn't that the truth?
One of the facts that you stated, and it's actually the first one, it has to do with researchers at Yale University, that they discovered it reduces the volume of gray matter in the areas of the brain responsible for self-control. And that's just shocking that what we think of as an exterior force that we internalize, which is stress, that it's damaging our brain so that we're not able to manage our emotions as well, that we're just, as you say, in a vicious cycle of trying to get through life, and yet our brains are not helping.
That's correct. I mean, anybody can relate to this who's been under enormous stress where you're not really thinking straight, you are just reacting, and that's basically showing you that you're suffering from this particular issue. You know, think about like when you're stressed and you're trying to work with a particular person, anybody that you have a relationship with, a coworker, somebody that you're in a physical relationship with, a family member, when you're stressed, you tend to be more irritable, you're less patient, you will not listen as well, you won't be show as much empathy, because your brain just is not functioning in a manner that is designed to basically be supportive. It's in literally survivor mode, because what we have to think about is the fact that our bodies, our brains and our bodies are still designed back in the Cro-Magnon days. And stress back then was in short-term doses. And typically we were trying to outrun a saber-toothed tiger or a T-Rex, something like that. So, you know, you think that freeze, fight or flight syndrome. Mm-hmm. So we would get that adrenaline, we'd get that cortisone in our bodies, and then we would race and get away from that. And then now we rest, and that was it. Unfortunately, most stress today is mental. And when we have that mental stress, we're still having that same freeze, fight, or flight reaction to it. So we're pounding the cortisone, we're pounding the adrenaline into our bodies. And what happens is over and over and over again, it causes inflammation in our body. Cellular inflammation is what causes disease, whether it be diabetes like I unfortunately got, or heart disease. Any of the major diseases that you can think of typically start with cellular inflammation. And cellular mm-hmm. inflammation comes from stress.
And I do want to get to your personal story, but I'd like you to introduce Ken, because he's part of the book, and I thought that was a really interesting use of his story, because a lot of authors will write, well, this is what happened to me, but you were able to bring in this dear friend of yours and introduce him and bring him along through. Can you tell us a little bit about him? Because part of the reason for this podcast is not just talking to authors about their books, but really kind of teasing them out and saying, how did you come up with this way of writing the book, and why did you decide to include him, and how did you get permission to include him?
Well, thank you for bringing him up. Ken and I were friends for over 30 years. We met in high school. We served as each other's best man at our weddings. And we also supported each other as proud fathers. Fast forward 20 years, and Ken, unfortunately, was dealing with his personal and professional lives that had gone awry. It happens to the best of us at some point, but he had both going on at the same time. And he was struggling. He was struggling mightily. And he ended up in the emergency room with intestinal cancer. Mm. And the doctors had to remove over 2/3 of his intestines.
Wow.
And then he had to undergo a very rigorous chemotherapy treatment campaign. And we would get together. He would be 3 weeks on the chemotherapy and then 1 week off to recharge. And so we typically would get together either at least by phone or in person on the week where he would be able to have some energy. And on many, many occasions, he told me he was absolutely convinced that his stress caused his cancer. Mm. And he kept on telling me that he had to, people needed to know about this. And, you know, and I was seeing this and I said, yeah, I know, because of my diabetes, I got that as well. But I was looking at him and he had actually had something where they had to remove organs from his body. And so we just talked, you know, continuously about that. And then I remember that he finished his chemotherapy regimen. And then 2 weeks later, he ended up back in the hospital because he got pneumonia, and his body, because of the chemotherapy, had lost a lot of its ability to fight off infection. And,
right.
And then 2 weeks after that, which was basically 2 weeks before his 49th birthday, he actually passed.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, he was we've just best friends, and I couldn't believe it. He wasn't the first friend from childhood that passed for me. I had one that died suddenly in an accident. Mm-hmm. But this was the first close friend that had passed away because of disease. And it just, I couldn't believe it. It was so shocking. And it got me to reevaluate what was going on with me. However, I still didn't truly absorb what happened to him and apply it to me until I ended up in the emergency room as well. And it's so crazy how you have to have a life-altering event like that to basically wake you up.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that was a great segue. So why don't you talk about how your story and how I think that became kind of the information that led to the writing of this book and really some major changes in your life to from leaving your job, starting a business, and moving forward in maybe a more healthy way.
Yeah, exactly. So I have to go back to 2008, because that was the perfect storm. You know, I'm sure, Elizabeth, you can appreciate, you know, those times where you are absolutely mentally and emotionally overwhelmed to the point where you just don't know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to me back in 2008, a perfect storm of stressful activities. My dad was dying. My mom had to have major hip surgery and needed care. I had a business to run. I had my children, which were very small at that time. And I had a, unfortunately, I had a marriage that was heading for a divorce. And so, needless to say, a lot of stuff on my shoulders. And everything culminated in a very short amount of time into stress-induced diabetes. Yet, did I listen to my body about what stress was doing to me? No, I just went ahead and kept on going. They gave me pills, and then pills weren't working. So then I had to take shots, and then shots weren't really working. So then they gave me a pump. And I continued for the next 10 years to burn the candle at both ends. I ended up in the emergency room with a severe case of diabetic ketoacidosis. And for the listeners who don't know what that is, my body was eating itself alive because of my stress. And the doctor said, good thing I came in when I did. I was about an hour before being comatose. And wow, it was crazy. And so there I am lying in the emergency room. They gave me 6 liters of fluid. And then later that evening, they transferred me to ICU. And I had been in the ER for, you know, sports-related injuries or having the kids with sports-related injuries. I'd never had an extended stay at the hospital until now. And yet here I was still kind of going, well, this was a bummer. I mean, what happened? And then my boss at the time knew that I was in the hospital in the ICU. And I get this text at around 6 a.m. in the morning, and it's from my boss saying, you have a webinar at 8 o'clock this morning that you need to run. What are you going to do about it? And so I looked at
that's crazy.
And, oh, no, I'll tell you what's crazy. All of a sudden, I went into stress mode like I always would, and all I had was my iPhone. And for those of us who've had to try and work with Outlook and iPhones and stuff, they aren't perfectly matched. Mm-hmm. And I'm here doing everything I can to try and reschedule that webinar. And the hospital was poking me every 30 minutes, checking my sugars. And my sugars, when I first got into the hospital, were completely off the charts. In fact, it couldn't record how high it was. But it was progressively coming down. So if you imagine, you know, a line coming down, it was coming back down to normal. And then all of a sudden, it was like a right angle, and it went straight up again as I was trying to get this webinar rescheduled. And thank goodness, one of the nurses who was attending to me, she comes over and she just a matter-of-factly says to me, you know, that's what put you in this bed in the first place. And that was my epiphany moment. And it was like, what am I doing to myself? Because my sugars were coming back down to normal. And now all of a sudden, they had gone up over 150 points without eating anything in literally 10 minutes. That's how my body responds to stress. And so I thought to myself, I can't do this anymore. And so the next day I got out of the ICU, and the following day after that I resigned and decided there's too much at stake here. I need to first take care of myself. And once I saw, by being mindful about what I was doing to try and reduce my stress, I knew that I could help others. And that's what I've been doing for the last year, little over a year.
So this is very recent that all of this happened.
Yep, exactly. It was back, and I was in the hospital actually in August of 2018.
That's crazy. And talk about having a graphic representation of what was going on in your body. And at least this time you listened, but I wonder if you hadn't seen that, if you would have listened to that nurse.
That's a good question. Probably not, because I was too focused on trying to be the star employee, the perfectionist, which mm-hmm. a lot of us can relate to. You want to make sure that you don't let anybody down. And that's what was going through my mind and why I was pushing and trying to make sure that that I was able to take care of everybody else, which is a classic. That is a classic that too many of us do, where we put everybody else, whether it's our work, our bosses, our coworkers, our kids, our parents, our friends, whoever, ahead of our needs, but nobody else takes care of us. Mm-hmm. We really need to make sure, both mentally and physically, that we focus on ourselves first, because if we don't take care of ourselves, we have no ability to take care of others if we get sick.
Yeah, it's that classic, if you're writing in a play and you put on your mask, oxygen mask first before you put on your children's, which seems counterintuitive because you want to save your child or your partner that's maybe acting like a child.
you got the same flight attendant. And yeah. And you know, they said one other thing too, which was hilarious, which was, if you're flying with more than one child, put the mask on the child with the most potential first.
That's great. That's great. So here you are. It's 2018. You've had this horrible experience and you quit your job. Just as an aside, what did your boss say when you said, "I quit"?
Well, what I did was I actually, instead of the senior director that I was reporting to, I actually submitted my resignation to the chief marketing officer, who was the person who actually had hired me. I had worked with her before at a previous company. Oh. And so I had an established relationship with her, and she totally was supportive and said, "You know, I really, really appreciate you letting me know. I don't blame you. It is a huge loss to see you go, but I totally get it." Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, once I told people what I was going to do, I was going to start doing research on the stress relief and try and figure out what are the best ways and share this information. So many of my coworkers were saying, "I wish I could follow in your steps because I'm stressed out, et cetera. I'm too fearful of taking that step, or I can't afford to take that step." And not a single person said, "What, are you crazy? How could you leave a stable, well-paying job where you were making such an impact for it?" Nobody said that. They all got it and understood and realized that I was doing the right thing.
It's nice to have that kind of agreement with what it is that you're doing, because that had to be a big life change for you. Just leaving a job, I've left a job before, and it is there is a decision to be made there. Now, mine was not, well, actually mine kind of was life-threatening, just in a different way. So you finished your work and you are looking for ways. Were you looking for ways to help yourself? And that's when the epiphany came of, "Hey, I could put this in a book."
Yes, exactly. So I started, realizing that this was either I had to change or I might not be around to meet my future grandchildren. So that was first and foremost. So I started looking into different techniques, talking to people, Googling things, and I started seeing all these different techniques, and I would try them. And, most of them worked, some of them didn't, but there was some value to each one that I tried. And then as I was talking to different people about what I was doing, they were saying, "Yeah, you should put that into a book." And I thought to myself, that is actually a pretty good idea, because then I looked and there wasn't a book like this. It was pretty much, okay, let's talk about one topic for 200-300 pages, but there wasn't anything that just said, I'm stressed right now in the moment and I've got 5 minutes to work on it. Go.
Right. Right. And so you came up with an acronym, which is LIGHTEN.
Mm-hmm. It's trademarked.
Okay. That's a smart thing to do. So tell us what LIGHTEN means. What does that stand for? And how did you come up with that?
So as I was doing my research on different stress relief tools and techniques, as well as what stress was doing to us, the research indicated that there was 7 areas of our life that typically our stress is going to come from. And if we can keep these in as much balance as possible, then you're going to have long-term stress relief. So the acronym first starts, the L is for livelihood, and that's your career. So where you make your money. And you know, when you think about that, most of us will spend more time working than doing just about anything else. And for those of us with workaholic tendencies, we may work more hours than we sleep. So it's important to make sure that we do something, a technique or two, to help keep us in balance because of the enormous amount of time that we're spending at work. So that's the L. The I is for, I like to call it the imagination, and that's your conscious mind. It's where your creativity comes from. It's the 5% of your brain that allows you to be creative. It's also the area of your brain that has your inner critic. So you need to make sure that you're creative with coming up with solutions when you're dealing with a stressful situation. The G I like to call your genius, your unconscious mind. And your unconscious mind is the other 95% of your brain. And it's where your autopilot is. So if, you know, if we've ever, everybody's probably either driven, done something where you go from point A to point B and you don't remember the journey, you just remember getting there. Mm-hmm. That's your unconscious mind driving, basically. And it's where your habits are formed. It's where your memories are stored. It's where your perception of the world exists. And it's where the real change happens, because you need to change it in your unconscious. So that's your genius. H is for physical health, which of course, you know, it's the reason why I do what I do today, because without your physical health, nothing else matters. And if you don't believe me, we've all had like the really bad flu. And, you know, when you have the flu, do you feel like doing anything other than just lying in bed?
No.
No, me neither. So it's imperative to keep your health as strong as possible. And then we have T for time, which, you know, is that wonderful asset that once it's gone, you can't get it back. It's really important to make sure that you make time, you know, today to take action rather than procrastinating and waiting until tomorrow or next week, next month, next year. I'll get to it when I get to it, because I thought the same thing until I ended up in the emergency room. So it's time is critical. The E stands for your environment. And that means that whether you're at work, at home, at school, when you have something important you need to do, you need to make sure that your environment is supportive of your efforts. And a great example, when I was working on my PhD back in the early 2000s, I would do most of my research on the weekends from my home office. And I would have the door closed, and my kids, again, they were small back then. They would walk right into the, you know, not respecting that, and wanted to play, wanted to spend time with daddy. And I would do it, and I don't regret that one bit, because it was a wonderful age. However, I would be stressed afterwards, because now, you know, I still had to work full time and plus, you know, 60 hours a week. And I had to figure out, where am I going to find the time to deliver on the research that I've got due for my degree. So you have to make sure that your environment is supportive. And then last, but certainly not least, is the N stands for network of relationships. The people in your life matter. And as I mentioned before about when you're stressed, you know, you're much more irritable and less patient with the people around you. You want to make sure that the people in your life, whether it's your coworkers, your family members, your friends, etc., that you treat them well. And the only way you can treat them well is to make sure that they're in alignment with the other aspects of the Lighten model. So that's how it all came out. And each of those tips that are in the books are organized into those areas that they were most effective. So it seemed like a good way to set the book up with.
And you did a marvelous job. I mean, there are so many different opportunities for people to try something new. I mean, each section has several different things that people can try. And I'm curious, do you find that people have issues with maybe one area more than another? Say, like, I know you work with sales professionals primarily.
Mm-hmm. Sales and marketing, basically stressed out entrepreneurs and sales and marketing professionals.
Okay. Do they tend to have similarities in which of the Lighten model they are stressed in, or does it run the gamut?
It's usually the most common areas where they come up. Of course, you know, the livelihood, because, you know, that's how that's their careers. And so that one comes up, dealing with certain people. So the network is big. Time is always an issue. That's huge. And then usually it is dealing with the unconscious, because a lot of people don't realize that the unconscious has an enormous amount of power. And our conscious mind is so often that inner critic is trying to say, well, no, you shouldn't try this. I want to keep control of this, et cetera, et cetera. So those are the ones that I usually see the most common. Physical health is a great indicator when somebody just notices that their body is not functioning to its peak. That's a quick indicator. But that's a common one that people understand, that they really, I don't have to do a lot of talking about that one. Mm-hmm. So I would say that the other ones are the ones that are most commonly coming up.
That does make sense. And have you had anybody that you've worked with or tried to work with that was like, I don't buy this stuff? I know that in the book, you've got some things that you've labeled woo-woo. Yeah. A little bit. And, you know, which is fair, because they are a little bit woo-woo. Have you had anybody say, no, I don't think this is going to work for me. I'll just go take another pill.
Yeah. Yeah. It's typically the type A personalities, the ones that are just go, 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 go. And the ones that are really stuck in their conscious mind. And for example, you know, I had this one high level marketing manager for a big brand company, and we were doing a technique where you get in touch with your unconscious mind and walking through it. It's called MER, mental and emotional release. And throughout the initial part of the process, she kept on saying, you know, well, wait a minute, what does this mean? What does that mean? And I said, thank you to your conscious mind. Go ahead and let's talk with your unconscious mind, because we just want to know, you know, as you say, the pill, just give me the quick solution. And in some cases, depending on the situation, you need to take a little bit more time. And so I've seen that happen, but inevitably what is great about what I do is that in a whole host, and in probably the vast majority of situations, my first step is just to have somebody try one of the techniques, because all I need to do is get one of them to work, and then they open the door to say, okay, I'm going to try something else. And really, if somebody can figure out one, two, or maybe three techniques that work for them, then they're on their way to avoiding the more sinister issues that can happen, both physically and mentally, related to stress.
And, you know, that does make sense. And then once they have those tools, those initial tools, then they are free to play with other things to see if they can incorporate something else. Is that true?
Absolutely. I kind of like, you know, put it to a similar kind of a metaphor is that it's like a restaurant menu. You come, you say, I wouldn't mind trying this. Let's see if I like that. Or maybe, or maybe even a buffet table. And you say, oh, that looks good. I'll try that. And I'll try this. Oh, I don't like that. Now I'll go back and I'll try something else. the fact that most of the tips in the book you can do in just a few minutes, you don't have to invest a lot of time, and you can figure out very quickly whether or not that works for you or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd love to talk about a few that stuck out for me as sure. I was perusing your book. The first one is don't multitask. What's funny is the ones that jumped out at me are ones that I have had conversations with other people about recently, and this is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. When I worked my corporate job, I was a supreme multitasker. As a mom, I could multitask between my then husband and my son, because they would both be talking to me at the same time, and I could listen to both, give them answers, and continue doing whatever it was I was doing, say cooking dinner. Now that I'm older, that's not the case. I am a monotasker, because I lose focus. If I'm in the middle of something and my little brain says, oh, you need to pay bills. And it's like, oh yeah, now I do. And it's like, okay, I'll stop doing this. I'll go do that. And I'll come back. Well, then I've lost the momentum that I had. And as a writer, I need my momentum when my creative imagination is moving forward. And if I stop it, I might as well just, you know, stop it, lock the door, walk away, and not plan on coming back for the rest of the day. So talk a little bit about the don't multitask and why that is so important and why it's in your book.
Yeah. So I think for listeners to imagine this, think about when you're sitting trying to have a conversation with somebody who's got their phone on and is looking at their phone, and then trying to hold the conversation as well. They're not doing either one very well, because their attention span is split between the small screen and you. So we're just not designed to do that well. And what happens is that so many of us in the corporate world in particular, when we are in a meeting, you'll see people who have their laptops on and they're looking at their email and they're attending the meeting as well, because they feel like they're so busy that they have no choice, or they feel like they have to look like they're busy. It depends on the culture of the organization and who they're working for. So those situations come up, and I did it as well. The interesting thing is I discovered in my research that when you multitask, the way that your brain, as you said, starting and stopping particular projects. So if we focus on one thing and one thing to its finish, we can put 100% of our attention on that project or whatever it is that we're tasked to do. And we can complete it in a reasonable amount of time, because all of our mind share is focused on that task. But then when you start adding additional tasks, so let's say, you know, at the beginning of your day, you have five different things that you need to work on at the same time. What happens is as you start adding tasks and you start switching from task to task, there's that ramp down and ramp up that happens in between those two projects. So, you know, you move from one project, like you fire off an email, you're waiting for an answer for something, and then you go on to the next one, and then you're trying to think, okay, now, what was I doing on that particular project? I got to think about that. Oh yeah, that's right. And then you're in the groove for whatever particular time. And then you need to go on to the next project because you're not finished with this one. And so you have to ramp down and ramp back up. You're losing valuable mind share. And the interesting thing is that the research that I found said that each time we have like two projects, we lose 20% of our time recalibrating between those projects. And if we do like the number five projects, the ramp up and ramp down could take as much as 80% of our mind share just in between projects. Wow. So if you think about that, that leaves 20% of your mind share to actually do task work. And if you have to split that 20% up into five projects, 4% of your time on each project. It is nuts. It is nuts. And so no wonder when people are multitasking, it takes them longer to get things done. And what they deliver potentially has errors in it because you're not fully focused on it, because you've juggle too many balls at once. It's so much better to, if whenever possible, is to just focus on one project at a time. It is going to be so much more efficient.
You know, another example of that, and I'm going to be hating on smartphones a little bit, is when you're driving and you pull up behind someone at a stoplight and the light turns green and the person doesn't move, and you kind of look up a little bit and try and see what they're doing in there, and they're reading their phone.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So then if what you're saying is true, that then they have to recalibrate their brain from the small screen to driving a car. Mm-hmm. And the amount of time it takes to say, okay, this is what I'm focused on now. You know, is there a chance that there's the opportunity for error, driver error, in that kind of an instance? Or certainly people that are reading their phone as they're driving is even worse.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because you're driving. I mean, I see it all the time on the highway. It is nuts because your car is basically a weapon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're driving at, you know, even if you're driving at 30, 35 miles an hour along on a neighborhood street. And, you know, if you look down even for 1 second, think about how much distance that vehicle has gone and how much time you need to stop. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. It's crazy. And so it's so, so dangerous. And it used to be back in the day when you would see somebody kind of swerving and acting erratically, driving slow, you would think, oh, that must be a drunk driver. Now I just assume it's somebody that's texting. And it's so easy. It's so easy to see the person texting. They think they're being sly because they're looking down on their lap so that, you know, the cops don't see them. You think the cops aren't stupid. They know exactly what's
right. Right. Yes, exactly. Well, the second one is the email purge.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, how many people have opened their email, and I think you gave the example of being gone on vacation and you come back and you've got, you know, 700 emails, which in corporate America is not unusual. And perhaps for some entrepreneurs, it's also not unusual. And the sinking feeling you get looking at all of those bolded emails that are demanding to be looked at. So talk a little bit about email purge and what you would suggest people do.
Yeah. So email purge is, you know, when you're on vacation and then you log into your email for the first time after a week or 2 weeks. And if it's anything like me, I used to get on average about 600 to 700 emails a week. So, you know, if you factor that in, it's about, it's a lot. I'd get easily close to 100 emails a day. And, you know, and emails would come on the weekends too, because people are working. And especially if you are working for an international company, you're getting emails coming at all hours of the night. So the email purge, I actually, with a former coworker of mine, she had burnout and she had to take time off from work. She was the head of product management, and she just stressed herself out to the point of burnout. And so she was medically cleared to take a break. And one of the things that was recommended to her was when her first day back, she clicked on the top email, the most recent one that came into her inbox, scrolled all the way down. And at this point she had what was the number? It was something like 3,000 or 4,000 emails.
Oh
yeah. And she went ahead and she scrolled all the way down and clicked on the last one, and it highlighted every single one of those. And she clicked the delete key. They all went away. And basically the technique there is, when you're gone, most times those emails, if you've assigned somebody else to take care of something, they've taken care of themselves while you've been gone. And if there's anything that really you needed to know about, or somebody really needed you to follow back up with them, they're going to follow up with you and check with you. You know, hey, welcome back from vacation. I wanted to check in and see if you got, you know, if you have an answer for me. Oh, okay. What is that? Because I had, you know, there were so many emails couldn't get through everything. So that is a huge way to do it, because really on average, you're going to end up with only 5% of that actually need your attention. And those people will reach back out to you if it was important.
Exactly. And you're right. There's probably nothing that you wouldn't be able to get from someone else, or they will talk to you directly. I love that one. I wish I would have known about that one, because that would have been a great use. Although, honestly, I could use it now because I belong to so many darn newsletters.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of do a mini email purge every day. It's like, nope, don't have time for this. I used to save them all. And that was a stressor on its own.
Yep,
I would see all those little numbers piling up. And it's like, I'm never going to read these. So then I go through and I start unsubscribing, because it's like, I'm doing you no favor by acting as if I'm interested when I just don't have time.
Yep.
So the next one is play fact or fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Sure. So what that is that, you know, that's when you're starting to worry about something in the future that really hasn't happened yet. And so you're thinking about, oh my gosh, let's see, I've got tickets to the play, let's say on Friday night, but oh my gosh, I've got so much work to do. And what happens if I get sick? Oh my gosh, if I'm going to get sick, you know, I wouldn't be able to go see the play. Or if I get sick and I do go see the play, I'm going to be, you know, I'm not going to feel good. And, you know, and you just work yourself up to a ridiculous level of stress that is unnecessary. So what you do is you just tell yourself, okay, let's ask the question, is it, what is real and what isn't, is basically what fact or fiction is you're trying to clarify, is there something that really I should be worrying about here? Or is it something that's just really in my head? So the technique, what you do is you set up, what I suggest is you put together, you know, you can draw, or you could even do this on a quick spreadsheet if you got in front of you. And you just basically ask yourself, you know, that example of whether or not, you know, you're going to get sick before the play. So column one, it says, I'm worried I'll get sick and have to miss the show on Friday. Then column two, I'm not sick now, so the thought is unwarranted and fictional.
Mm-hmm.
Column three starts to talk about, what do you do to improve your chances to make sure that you can see the play? Is, I'll make sure I take care of myself and get proper rest so that I'm healthy for my show. And then there's a recap, basically a reflection. And column four, I didn't get sick and I made it to my show. My worries were needless and it didn't affect my health. So that you have a learning from that. And after you have that learning, then the next time you start thinking, oh my gosh, I've got tickets to the football game on Sunday and it might rain, I'm going to get sick. Then you think, well, wait a minute. Wasn't I worried about the play on Friday night and nothing happened? Why worry about something that is in the future that you may or may not happen?
Mm-hmm. Right?
So it's all fact or fiction.
I can think of a couple of people that could probably use that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a creative way to talk yourself out of a stressor.
Absolutely. Because we do, the thing about mental stress, you know, so there's no surprise that most stress is mental. What people are surprised about is that most of our stress is self-induced. We're doing it to ourselves. Nobody else is doing it to us. We're doing it to ourselves. And something like fact or fiction is dealing with the anxiety we make because we're getting anxiety about something in the future that may or may not happen.
And honestly, it also, the fact or fiction, I think, doesn't it also kind of deal with how we talk to ourselves and how we, you know, like something goes wrong and it's, oh, I'm an idiot. Why did I do that? We can be so cruel to ourselves. And I think a lot of that is subconscious.
Uh-huh.
And you already mentioned the MER technique or the MER
yes.
method.
Uh-huh.
And I want to get to a couple more of the different activities that you suggest, but I want you to talk a little bit more about that method because it addresses the subconscious beliefs that we don't even realize we have. They've always been there. And that's just the way things are. And that technique seems to prove that thought incorrect.
Correct. So what happens? It's actually, just to clarify, it's in your unconscious.
Sorry.
Yeah, no worries. I just want to make sure that the listeners know exactly, because you have your conscious, your subconscious, which is in between, and then you have your unconscious. So our conscious is where our inner critic is, and it's there to try and protect us. And so the critic comes out and says, you know, you can't do this. You're not good enough, et cetera, et cetera. It's trying to protect you. Your unconscious is where certain events over your lifetime have affected your decision-making. And the process of MER, what it does is you get in touch with your unconscious mind and you look at the event before it actually happened. And why you do that is because it takes, by doing it before it happened, or looking at it from kind of like a disassociated standpoint, you're looking at the event from behind in a timeline. I know it sounds woo-woo, but go with me on this. What happens is the emotional charge of that event, because it hasn't happened yet in your timeline, goes away. And what you do is you try and determine what the original source event was that caused you to have that particular emotion, whether it be anger, fear, sadness, hurt, guilt, etc. And then you move forward towards now in your timeline and look at each subsequent event, and you remove the negative charge and you maintain the positive learnings on each subsequent event up to coming back to now. And it removes all of that emotional baggage that we've been carrying perhaps for our entire lives and didn't know why. And our unconscious mind wants to get rid of it. It doesn't want to carry it because it knows it's not good. Hmm. It just needs a channel to get rid of it. And so if you can have the conscious mind step aside, have the unconscious mind be able to remove that baggage, and then you do testing with the conscious mind, asking, you know, if something like this were to happen now, how would you feel? And it's absolutely amazing. If you find the very first source event where caused that negative emotion to start happening, then that whole, like a chain of dominoes, it knocks everything out of the way. And the person just has this huge, huge sense of relief. In many cases, and it's been clinically proven here, in many cases, a 3 to 4 hour process, they call it a breakthrough session, you can have an enormous amount of emotional baggage removed that might take years in week-to-week therapy to take care of. So it can be really, really powerful depending on what the situation is that the person has and what they want to take care of, and of course the skill set of the practitioner.
That's fascinating. And you have gotten certified in this technique?
I have. I'm not only am I a master practitioner in it, but I'm also a trainer in it.
Fascinating. I could just see where somebody who's holding them, they're being held back and they don't really know why, or they just have this feeling of maybe something simple like, I'm not good enough. Mm-hmm. And being able to go back in time to that first time, maybe a parent said that to them, you're just not good enough, or a teacher or someone they looked up to, and how empowering that would be to finally be able to say, no, that's not true.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not kidding. I have actually had clients who realized that, you know, that I'm not good enough. It was disappointment because their parents wanted the other gender baby, something like that. And they said, oh, it's a girl, or, oh, it's a boy, I wanted a girl. And that initial disappointment that just got passed on. So it could be literally at birth. It's amazing. Oh,
wow. That's crazy. Yeah. Oh, so yeah. You're not even verbal. You really can't verbalize it, but yet it's there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Our
brains are amazing. And depending on, you know, if the person is open to it and believes that there could be such a thing as past lives, It's something where it could have happened in a past life that was passed down. It could have happened genealogically from some family member. You never know what it was until you go back with the conscious mind. And the conscious mind knows. That's the crazy thing. The conscious mind knows. The unconscious mind knows. Mm-hmm. The conscious mind doesn't. The conscious mind is just assuming that it knows and is trying to protect. And wants to keep control, but it's the unconscious mind that knows this. And if you just can get in touch with it and be able to listen to what the unconscious mind is saying, you can direct it to be able to get rid of whatever that negative emotion is and be free of it. It's just amazing.
Well, you might get people calling you just for that. That's we're all walking around with a bunch of crap in our heads that we Yep. really don't know is there, and we act weird and don't know why, and we keep sabotaging ourselves and we're really not sure why. And boy, I could just see such a use for that.
Oh, it is. It is. And you know, once you've done a breakthrough session, then you can do, I like to call it tune-ups. And tune-ups can be like, you know, you just have one particular thing where you just need to do a 5 to 10 minute process and basically get rid of a particular emotion. Or, you know, you might have a limiting belief that, oh, I can't do this, but I don't know why. Let's get rid of it that way. Or, you know, we were talking about anxiety and worrying about something in the future. You can actually do that as well with MER and look at something past when it happened and think of it from the positive side that it went well. So you'd get rid of that anxiety.
Oh man, that's very cool.
It is. It is. It's like, I call it a superpower. I really do. It's amazing. It's what it can do for people.
It has to be so gratifying for you to see someone maybe de-age when they're able to let go of something that they didn't realize they were holding on to.
It's amazing. And here's another crazy thing about it too. Once we release this emotional baggage, our vibration, our physical vibration around other people changes. Have you ever, you know, noticed that, you know, from both a positive and a negative, we all have been around people who, you know, that the walking cloud, I like to call it, where they walk in and all the energy gets sucked out of the room. Mm-hmm. Just the opposite happens when you have somebody who's released that emotional baggage and now is much more free and feels good. You get attracted. You want to be around those people that are you know, exuding this positive energy. And that's what happens. It's crazy. I had one client who after she did the MER work, I kid you not, she had this ongoing issue with her mom. They had a big fight that had escalated into a cold war over a month previously. And her mom called her that next day to apologize. And her mom had never apologized for anything.
Wow.
I can't say that I did anything there, but I'm sorry. I don't knock anything I don't truly understand, but that'll, I mean, it was like, really, that's fantastic. And the only thing that she could explain is that she released that emotional baggage and her energy was so much more positive that her mom, her mom sensed it and decided to call.
It triggered something positive.
It did.
Wow. I like that story. So we're actually coming up at the end of our time, and there is just one more, one of your points that I wanted to just throw out because this is probably my favorite.
Okay.
And I think it's one that people do not allow themselves to do enough, and it's becoming an issue with children. And that is your point, allow yourself to be bored.
Oh, yes. It's so true. How, you know, again, going back to what we started our conversation about, that we're so wired with technology and we feel like we got to go, we got to do it, go, 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 go. But if you can, let's say that you have a meeting that gets canceled and that hour gets freed from your calendar. Instead of just doing more work, what if you just sit back or you go for a walk and you don't do anything but just enjoy the time being with yourself? How often do we do that?
Mm-hmm.
We don't. We don't. And I like to align this with another technique that I call detox from technology, obviously, because this has been a theme that we've been talking about throughout the our conversation, is when we aren't connected electronically, we are more present with each other. And so that also includes ourselves. So why not just enjoy the outside if it's a nice day? Or you know what? Maybe instead of doing more work, is there a book that you've been meaning to start reading? Why not pick that book up and take the hour to just enjoy a book that you wanted to read for your own enjoyment? You don't have to be doing something at every minute of the day just to be able to get everything done. Because guess what? The world isn't going to end if you didn't get all your work done on one day. I had to educate my kids about this with their electronics when we would go camping once a year.
Mm-hmm.
Camping, I purposely did it because we couldn't get a Wi-Fi signal. And in most cases, I was hoping, and it usually happened, that couldn't get a cell signal either. And not only myself, but they would go through that detox. And it's like, oh my gosh, you know what? The next day, all of a sudden, everybody is in better spirits. They're not worried. And the world didn't end. Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. That's a big one for me. And it's one that I tell myself fairly frequently, because it's so easy to get sucked into our phone or some type of technology. You know, even sitting at the doctor's office, you know, I mean, what do we used to do when we would go to the doctor's office? We'd probably read a magazine
mm-hmm. yep.
that the doctor had. So of course that was kind of separating us, but we were still aware of our surroundings. It's so easy to literally be sucked into your phone that you don't even hear other things going on around you because you're so focused on a video that you're watching if you have earbuds in, then you can't even hear the outside world.
Yep. Yep.
So
how many times have you seen somebody bang into a pole or something like that because, or they walk right out in front of a car. They're not even yeah. paying attention. I mean, it's crazy because,
yes.
and, you know, we have that habit of what I like to call Pavlov's dogs, where a ping from a text is more important than the person sitting in front of you.
Yes.
It's horrible. It's, you know, so detoxing from that. And, you know, I mentioned in the book that if it's, you know, if you don't like camping, don't worry about that. What, you know, a lot of people love to go to the spa. So why not just leave your phone in the car, not in the locker room of the spa? Because what happens if, you know, when you go back to go to the restroom or get a towel or something, you're going to go and look at your phone and check out whatever the latest is, whether it's messages or negative news, etc. Mm-hmm. Leave it hidden in the car. That forces you to detox.
Great advice. All of this has been great advice, very enlightening. I'm so glad you wrote your book. I am sorry that you went through the health challenges that you've gone through to get to this part, but the rest of us are definitely going to benefit by the fact that you wrote your book.
Oh, thank you for the kind words, Elizabeth. I appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome, because, you know, I think the Lighten model, some of the things in there are common sense, you know, and people may read your book and go, well, oh, duh. But so many are not. And the fact that they may be common sense, but people don't think of them, I think is the bigger message. You've managed to put so many techniques into one book that there will be something someone can try that they will have success with and begin to heal from stress and begin to recognize that they can live life without the constant on that we feel like we have to have all the time.
Yep, I would agree. And really, you know, what I want to emphasize to your listeners is that it doesn't take a lot of time. if they, you know, if they just put a reminder in their phones to do a, you know, a 1-2 5-minute stress relief thing first thing in the morning when they wake up, or, you know, last thing they do before they go to bed, just get into some sort of a very, very simple habit can just pay off in droves. It mm-hmm. really can.
So how can people find you?
So that all they have to do is go to PeteAlexander.com.
Okay. Well, that's easy enough. And the name, and you, oh, your book is also on Amazon.
It is. And it's in both, Kindle version, printed version, and also audiobook.
Great. Well, I would encourage everyone to go check out the book. It is fascinating. Yes, I have a psychology background, and that's probably why I find all of this fascinating. But I think there is a big need for what you are saying to people. So I'm really glad you wrote this book. I am equally glad that you took the time to be on the Author Confidential today. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
Elizabeth, thank you again for having me, and thank you to your listeners for their time as well. I hope it was of benefit for them.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of The Author Confidential. It means a lot that you listen. Thank you. Remember to check the show notes for information and links that may have been discussed in the episode. You can learn who future guests will be, discover more about this podcast, and learn a bit about me at theauthorconfidential.com. And I'd be most appreciative if you'd rate and review this show on whatever platform you frequent for podcasts. Check back here again next week for another riveting episode of The Author Confidential. This is Elizabeth Tanz. See you next week.